This presentation was made to Liberty Church on March 7th on our Wednesday evening Bible seminar, and the audio for that seminar did not take. We had some technical difficulties with that. So I wanted to make sure that this material got to our church folks, and I'm going to review this in an audio format and duplicate it for the rest of our church folks who were not able to make it. And I may even podcast this on the internet as well. This podcast, this audio file, is called The Talpiot Tomb. And let me just mention, first of all, what's going on with this material. Well, on March 4th, Sunday night, 2007, the Discovery Channel aired a documentary entitled The Lost Tomb of Jesus. It was directed by Simka Jakubowicz and produced by James Cameron, who has brought us the Terminator movies, the movie The Titanic. And this was aired on a two-hour special, followed up with an hour called A Critical Look with Ted Koppel. Well, what is the issue all about? Well, in 1980, there was a tomb discovered in the Talpiot neighborhood of Jerusalem, and it contained several ossuaries. An ossuary is a bone box that was in use for about 100 years in the first century there in Israel. What would happen is that they would take the dead body of somebody and put them in a niche in a tomb, and then a year later they would come back after the body had decomposed and put the bones in a box. And sometimes they would inscribe a name on that box, other times, many times, they would not. But this bone box is called an ossuary. And there's an article I got from MSNBC that says, in Israel today, first century ossuaries are so ubiquitous, they are used in gardens and living rooms as planters. So these ossuaries are nothing new. They're well known. But the Talpiot tomb was discovered, like I said, in 1980, containing some very interesting ossuaries. There were six ossuaries that had names inscribed on them. There was one named Jesus, son of Joseph. There was another one with the name Mary, one with the name Josie, which is a nickname for Joseph. Also, there was an ossuary with the name Matthew on it, and then one with Judah, son of Jesus. And the most interesting and most controversial ossuary was inscribed in Greek with the name Mary on it as Mariamne, or actually Mariamenu. So what is the claim of this documentary? Well, the claim is that the family tomb of Jesus Christ of the New Testament has been found. Also, the documentary is asserting that Jesus and Mary Magdalene were married and that they had a son named Judah. And the bottom line is that Jesus' body was placed in an ossuary, which is a year-long process to do, and therefore there could not have been a physical resurrection of Jesus Christ. Well, this presents a great opportunity to Christianity, to the church in general. We should look at this as a positive event, and it also highlights for us that Christianity is not a religion. It's something that is rooted in history. It is something real. It is something that we can look at and handle with our hands, look at with our eyes, rummage through the artifacts of history with our hands, our eyes, and our feet. Also, there's a great opportunity because the world is thinking about this issue, and the church had better be on the ball and ready to respond. Another great benefit of this is that we as Christians are challenged to study. And actually, I look at this as an opportunity handed to us on a silver platter. So what are the issues at hand? Well, the issues at hand are that there are several names in the tomb that we need to look at. We also need to consider the DNA evidence as it was presented in the documentary. Americans are very vulnerable to the catchphrase, DNA evidence, and look at that as though that is the bottom line for everything. Also, the documentary claims that there was statistical evidence to show that this must be the family tomb of Jesus of Nazareth. Now, this is all very tricky material, and as we go through it, and as we went through it last night on the PowerPoint, we need to work at making sure that we distinguish between the Talpiot Jesus and the New Testament Jesus. We have to keep these things distinct in our mind because the documentary and the issue at hand here is trying to conflate the two individuals. Well, this family tomb tells us of common names that were used in first century Israel. For example, the names Joseph and Jesus were very popular in the first century. And Gary Habermas reminds us that Jesus appears in at least 99 tombs and on 22 ossuaries, and the name Joseph appears on 45 ossuaries. Richard Bauckham mentioned, and I believe he's talking simply about tombs in general, that Joseph is found 218 times, Judah is found 164 times, Jesus is found 99 times, and Matthew is found 62 times. And Richard Bauckham is the professor of New Testament at St. Andrews. And he mentions that we should note that the surviving six names are only six of many more who were buried in this family tomb. There may have been as many as 35. The six people whose names we have could have belonged to as many as four different generations. This is a large family tomb, which would certainly have been used for quite some time by the same family. We should not imagine a small family group. Some members of the family of Jesus we know lived in Jerusalem for only 3 decades, from the death of Jesus to the execution of his brother James in AD 62. None of our other evidence would suggest that there were so many of them as to require a tomb of this size. So what Mr. Bauckham is mentioning to us is that after the crucifixion of Christ, there were family members of the New Testament Jesus that lived in Jerusalem, and that it lasted for about 3 decades, and the family was small and would not need a tomb the size of what is found in Talpiot. Now, let's look at the names on the ossuaries more specifically. This comes from the Discovery website itself. We see a picture here of the ossuary with the inscription that says Yeshua Bar Yosef. And it says in Aramaic lettering, scratched crudely into the narrow side of a chest under the rim, the first name is preceded by a large cross mark of unknown significance, and the English translation is Jesus, son of Joseph. Well, Professor Amos Kloner, the Israeli archaeologist who first cataloged the ossuaries, mentioned to the Jerusalem Post, and was also cited on a couple other websites that I noted, he said, the name Jesus, son of Joseph, has been found on 3 or 4 ossuaries. So this is not remarkably new and totally unique material. He goes on to say, give me scientific evidence and I'll grapple with it. But this, and he's referring to these assertions in the documentary, this is manufactured. Stephen Fan, president of Jerusalem's University of the Holy Land and also an expert in Semitic languages, told the National Geographic News that he also has doubts about the movie's claims. He says, I don't think it says Yahshua or Jesus. It says Hanun or something, Fan said after viewing high-resolution images of the ossuary inscription in question. Well, there is a minor dispute of whether even the inscription says Jesus, son of Joseph. But that's really not a large contention, but it is noted. Dr. Charles L. Quarles, chair of Christian Studies at Louisiana University, said, even by the calculations of the authors of the Jesus Family Tomb, which is the book that parallels the documentary, there were approximately 1,008 men named Jesus, son of Joseph, who lived in first century Palestine. They calculate that 1 out of every 79 Jewish males in Palestine during the century of ossuary use was named Jesus, son of Joseph. The source for that is thebiblicalfoundations.org. There's another inscription on one of the ossuaries, and it is the inscription Mariamne. Now, the Discovery site tells us that Mariamne, or Mariamene, a Mara, in Greek lettering, incised on the top center of the long back side, is translated Mary, known as Master. Now, this is the initial view of this ossuary on the website, and they want the viewer to see that this inscription means Mary, known as Master. And they assert that this must be the ossuary for Mary Magdalene. Well, my question is, how does Mary Magdalene get in the picture? The producers want to lead you to believe two things. An ancient text named the Acts of Philip shows that Mariamne is Mary Magdalene and the wife of Jesus. Also, they want us to believe that Mariamne means Mary Magdalene, the Master, and they are asserting that she was truly one of the first and true leaders of the early church. Well, the question is this really Mary Magdalene? Now note what Ben Witherington says about this ancient text called the Acts of Philip, which really undergirds the documentary's view that this Mariamne is Mary Magdalene. Ben Witherington says, what we have is a 14th century manuscript which is theorized to go back to the 4th century A.D. It does not identify Mariamne as Mary Magdalene. Rather, it identifies her as the sister of Philip the Apostle. And so the Acts of Philip notes that Mariamne is the sister of Philip. Well, this is inaccurate in and of itself, but that is what the text says. What did the Acts of Philip continue to say? Well, I took some time yesterday to read the Acts of Philip. It's tedious reading. It can give you fits trying to just work your way through it. But I noted that Mariamne, the character Mariamne in the Acts of Philip, is never identified as Mary Magdalene. The Mariamne of the text is nowhere stated to be married to Jesus. This assertion by the documentary is completely empty, and you can read the Acts of Philip for yourself. It's not very long. It's interesting material. It's kind of crazy. They have Philip converting a goat and a leopard to Christ. They have Mariamne turning into a box of fire at another point. They have Philip using the ground to swallow up his enemy up to the ankle, where there's a dispute, and they continue to dispute, and so the ground swallows his enemy up to his waist, and there's a continuing argument. Then the ground swallows up Philip's enemy to his neck, and they continue to fight, and then Philip just has the ground swallow him up completely. Just some crazy stuff like that, and they do show Philip to be kind of an angry individual. Mary Magdalene is hanging over in the thinking of Americans, mostly due to the Da Vinci Code, and I wanted to mention some things that people commonly think about Mary Magdalene. First of all, was she a prostitute? Daryl Bach, in his book, Breaking the Da Vinci Code, says, the first mention of Mary as a prostitute comes from a homily, or a sermon, delivered by Pope Gregory the Great in AD 591. In all likelihood, this notion resulted from confusion concerning passages in the Gospels of Luke and John. So the Pope took his sermon, he confused some things, and he conflated two characters, one a prostitute, the other Mary Magdalene, and that is how this more likely got started, this rumor about her being a prostitute. Was Mary Magdalene present at the cross as Jesus' wife, like the documentary wants to assert? Daryl Bach goes on to say, in each note about her presence at the cross, she was not alone, but was part of a larger group of women. Mary, the mother of Jesus, was there, the mother of James and Joseph, mother of the sons of Zebedee was there, but she was not there by herself in a special way as the wife of Jesus. Which brings up the contention, was she even Jesus' wife in the first place? Daryl Bach says, there is no clear text outside the Bible indicating that Jesus was married or that Mary Magdalene was his wife. This matches what is in the New Testament. So he's saying, there's nothing outside the New Testament that clearly says this. There's nothing inside the New Testament that says this. This is simply an assertion. And even the later Gnostic texts, I don't believe, are being treated correctly to make this assertion out of the extra-biblical material. Well, what does it matter? Well, here's a quote from John Rush. The Jesus-Mary Magdalene connection appeals to our tabloid mentality. It is the ancient equivalent of grocery store checkout aisle publications. Dan Brown, the author of The Da Vinci Code, has promoted this connection to highlight feminist viewpoints and historical fabrications in the thoroughly debunked Da Vinci Code. The issue at hand is being accurate historically. Well, let's go back to the Discovery website and see some more material about the inscription Mariamne, Mariamenu, Amara. Well, the Discovery website says this is the only inscription in Greek in the tomb. Well, in that statement there is inaccurate. This is the only inscription on an ossuary in Greek in the tomb. When I watched the documentary, they noted there was a Greek inscription on the wall of the tomb. Anyway, continuing on, the website says, though Mara is a diminutive of Mary, it is also the Aramaic word for master. It conceivably might have been a term of respect for Mary Magdalene. Now, when we read this material from the Discovery website promoting the assertions of the documentary, we have to really look at the language and just see what it's saying on the face. They concede that this is a Greek inscription for Mariamenu, a Mara. Now, what is the word Mara? In Greek, it is a shortened word for Mary. Actually, elsewhere, it is a shortened word for Martha. But then they lay aside the Greek term, the Aramaic word. They just put them side by side, and they say it conceivably might have been a term of respect for Mary Magdalene. So what they're wanting to push the viewer to do is to be riding their Greek horse. This is Mariamenu, a Mara, which means Mary, of Mary, Martha. And they want you to just, for no good reason, hop over onto the Aramaic horse and ride its saddle and change the definition of the Greek term for the Aramaic similarly sounding word for master, so that they can assert that Mary Magdalene is the master and the true inheritor or the true leader of the early church, and now we're full blown back into the Da Vinci Code conspiracy hot air. What is the Mariamne or the Mariamenu material? Well, if you dig further in the Discovery Channel's own evidence page, and I was tipped off to do so by the podcast by Chris Rosebro at Extreme Theology, I went in there and looked, and sure enough, it says Mara, a contraction of Martha, is used here as a second name. So Mara does not mean the Aramaic word master. Even in their own evidence page, it says that Mara is a contraction of Martha, and it is used as a second name for the person inside this ossuary. They go on to say that this name, too, is common in the Jewish feminine onomasticon. So, Mariamenu Mara. Craig Evans notes that the inscription could be interpreted Mariamne's daughter Mara, or Martha. Two other experts, Cloner and Romani, translated the ossuary of Mariamne, who is also called Mara, and we know that that's a shortened term for the word Martha, the ossuary of Mariamne, who is also called Martha. Oh, but they have the DNA. You can tell us that this is not Mary Magdalene. You can tell us that this simply means not master, but Martha. But what about the DNA evidence? Well, James White, an apologist at Alpha Omega Ministries, had been emailing the doctor who did the work on the DNA testing for the documentary. And his name is Dr. Carney Matheson. And in an email back to James White, Dr. Matheson mentions when they did the filming and on the documentary, they asked every question under the sun with permutations and manipulations. I provided the investigators with all the possibilities. They were not brother and sister, mother and child, maternal cousins, maternal grandparents and child, etc. I also mentioned all the possibilities, which I should not have done in hindsight. He says these include father and daughter, paternal cousins, half-brother and sister sharing the same father, or simply unrelated individuals. What is Dr. Matheson saying? Well, I'm not a geneticist, nor am I an archaeologist, nor am I a New Testament scholar, nor am I an expert in Semitic and ancient languages. I'm just a simple guy sitting here trying to do the best he can to study and share information with his church folks. But from what I understand, that the DNA that was used in the test was taken from the Jesus Son of Joseph ossuary. There was DNA taken from the Mariamenu Amara ossuary. The DNA is called mitochondrial DNA. It is not nuclear DNA. Mitochondrial DNA can only exclude or prove maternal relationships. They cannot exclude or prove paternal connections. And this is what Dr. Matheson is saying. The Jesus Son of Joseph ossuary and the Mariamenu Amara ossuary are shown not to have maternal connections, but it doesn't exclude that they could have had paternal connections. And that's why he said that the possibilities of their relationship could include that Yeshua, son of Joseph, could have been father of Mariamna. They could have been paternal cousins. They could have been half-brother and sister, or simply unrelated individuals. Well, Dr. Matheson closes out his quote by saying, the media does what they want, and that is obviously the case here. Well, what does the DNA evidence show? Just by way of review, it only shows that Jesus of Talpiot and Mariamna did not have the same mother. That's it. That's all it shows. So let's review Jesus. The Talpiot tomb's Jesus is not shown to be the Lord Jesus Christ of the New Testament. The Talpiot tomb's Jesus appears to belong to an upper class or wealthy family in Jerusalem. Nothing demands that the Talpiot Jesus and Mariamna were married. Now let's review Mariamna. Nothing links Mariamna as Mary Magdalene. The best I could come up with concerning the Acts of Philip and the link towards Mary Magdalene was that maybe the author, and I forget who said this, maybe the author of the Acts of Philip took a composite of several women in the New Testament and turned them into his character Mariamna of the Acts of Philip. So at the best, she's simply a composite character of New Testament women, but nothing links her directly to Mary Magdalene. Also, nothing shows that the New Testament Jesus and Mary Magdalene were married, and the DNA tests simply show that Jesus and Mariamna of Talpiot had different mothers. So we can assume that they were married. We don't have to assume that they were married. There are other possibilities. More names on the tomb. Much was made of the name Josie, which is a nickname for Joseph, on this other ossuary. The Discovery website says, Josie, in Hebrew script, on the upper half of a long side of the chest, left of center, carved in a similar style to the Maria ossuary, the English translation is Josie, a nickname for Joseph. Now, the movie stresses that this must be the New Testament Jesus' brother due to how rare the nickname is. But the film is leaping from the Talpiot Josie to the New Testament Josie. The documentary would have us believe that this family tomb is missing a father. And as Gary Habermas reminds us, if we only make the connections that are explicitly made in the tomb, what we need to do is make sure that we're looking at the relationships as they stand right there and as they're noted within the Talpiot tomb. And if we do, that the Joseph that is supposedly the father of Jesus, this man can be accounted for much more simply. Chris Rosebrough mentions that it would make far more sense to identify Josie as the father of the Jesus in this tomb. When we do that, the family tree begins to look a lot different than the family tree of Jesus of Nazareth, and that's for sure. What more about Josie? From the Discovery Channel's own evidence page, they even note this. They say the similarity of this ossuary and its inscription with that of Maria on ossuary number 706, both from the same tomb, may indicate that these are the ossuaries of the parents of Yeshua and the grandparents of Yehuda. So they're saying that Joseph, Josie, and Mary, these two ossuaries, are very likely the parents of Jesus in the tomb and the grandparents of Judah, the son of Jesus, in the tomb. So all the family relationships there, the major ones, are accounted for within this one site. Now, there's another name in the tomb, and that is the name Matthew on another ossuary. But the problem with Matthew is that he simply just doesn't fit. There is no Matthew mentioned in the New Testament Jesus family. And so the documentary tries to go back and associate Mary as the mother of Jesus of the New Testament, and since she had some Matthews in her lineage, well, then this Matthew must be accounted for because there were some Matthews in the descendants there that Mary comes out of. But that's just an association. That's a leap. That is not a logical demand. There is a better possibility, and Chris Rosebrough at ExtremeTheology.com mentions a more plausible family tree constructed from the tomb's data would be that of the Talpiot ossuaries, Joseph, nicknamed Josie, and Mary would be the parents. They would be the parents of Jesus and Matthew. Jesus would have been married to the Talpiot Mariamna, who has no connections with Mary Magdalene, and then that Jesus and Mariamne were the parents of Judah. This family is clearly not the family of Jesus of Nazareth. A whole separate picture is emerging, and it is emerging from the data itself, not being read back into by conspiracy theorists of our day. But what about the statistics? Well, I'm not a math guy. I couldn't wade myself through the statistics if I tried. And I do good to keep the checkbook up to date. But the statistical expert on the documentary itself, and I hope I pronounce his name correctly, Andre Feuerverger, is the professor of mathematics and statistics at the University of Toronto. He was talking about this documentary on the internet, doing some internet writing back and forth with people, and he mentions some interesting insights into the statistical analysis. First of all, he notes himself, the results of any such computations are highly dependent on the assumptions that enter into it. And so there is a foundation for these statistics, and they are called assumptions. And what are these assumptions? If these assumptions can be discredited, well, then the statistics themselves fall away from an unsound foundation. Well, he says, we assume that Marianamu A. Mara is a singularly highly appropriate appellation for Mary Magdalene. He says, we simply assume that she is Mary Magdalene. Well, we've already shown that that assumption is not necessary, and in fact, it is pretty much intellectually dishonest to do so. And then their statistics guy goes on to say, note that this important assumption is contentious, and furthermore, that statistically, this assumption drives the outcome of the computation substantially. So if you pull away the assumption that Mariamne is Mary Magdalene, well then what drives these computations substantially is gone, and the rest of the statistics will fall like a house of cards. He says, it is assumed that Yose or Yosa is not the same person as the father Yosef who is referred to on the ossuary of Yeshua. So we look outside the tomb to find another Yose when there is one already in the tomb that we could more easily associate the name to. So we make that assumption. He says, we assume that Yose or Yosa is a highly appropriate appellation for the brother of Jesus who is referred to as Joseph in Mark 6:3 of the New Testament. We also assume that the Yehuda, son of Yeshua, ossuary does not invalidate the find, but we ignore it in the computations. You see, there's no historical evidence that Jesus was married, let alone married to Mary Magdalene, and let alone that he had a son named Judah. But he says we ignore this in the computations. And he says this last assumption is contentious. Well, that's an understatement. Well, the statistics of this documentary are under fire. In the PowerPoint presentation I made last night, I noted several websites and put them up on the screen for people to look at so that they could see how the statistics are really falling apart. Gary Habermas also notes, just as miscellaneous items, that there are a few other problems with the whole documentary itself. He says Jesus was not from Jerusalem, so why would the family tomb be located there, especially for more than one generation, as was usually the case? He says this tomb is considered to be an upper-class crypt, or at least to have been a very expensive one, unlike Jesus' family standing. And so I watched some of the talk about this documentary and some of the newscasts and side items there. And the producer, I don't know if it was Yakubovich or if it was James Cameron, somebody said, well, Jesus may have had the resources to have an upper-class crypt because he was the leader of a religious movement, and at the end he would have had those resources. But he's reading back into the first century, the late 20th century, early 21st century phenomenon of the televangelist or the rich preacher man. And he's reading back into that and placing it on Jesus to justify such an expensive tomb. That's what the whole documentary does, is just a reading into these things. We know from the New Testament that Jesus did not have a home. He did not have wealth. All he had on his back was gambled for at the foot of the cross by the Roman soldiers. And he was a very poor man. Gary Habermas continues to say, it should not be forgotten either that these tombs were frequently kept over a period of decades. Therefore, this tomb could easily contain persons from earlier family generations or even adopted members whose parents had passed away, or even treasured servants. So these are some of the other possibilities for the relationship between the Jesus of Talpiot and the Mariamne in the ossuary. And anyway, there are many options there. Mariamne could have been married to Matthew, for all we know. In the ancient literature, Jesus is not known as the son of Joseph. And so that also further distances the Jesus of Talpiot from the Jesus of the New Testament. William G. Deaver, a retired professor of Near Eastern Archaeology and Anthropology at the University of Arizona, was part of the panel on the critical look at the documentary with Ted Koppel that aired for an hour after the Discovery Channel did their two-hour special. And I noted that Jakubowicz and Tabor took all the oxygen out of the room, especially with the first two experts that were questioning the veracity of their program. And so in my mind, it's like, okay, they had 2 hours to make the case, and they take up most of the time in the critical look as well. And I was hoping to hear more from William Deaver, but I found a quote that he had given to the Washington Post, or at least was picked up by the Washington Post. Here's what this expert says. He said, "I'm not a Christian. I'm not a believer. I don't have a dog in this fight." A little bit later, he noted, the documentary, it's a publicity stunt, and it will make these guys very rich, and it will upset millions of innocent people because they don't know enough to separate fact from fiction. So the whole documentary begins to unravel. It's a tangled mess. It's a layered cake of one false assumption on another. And it's going to fall flat. It's going to be debunked. In fact, one website I read said that this might be the only documentary that was thoroughly debunked before it aired. Where does this leave us? Finally, it leaves us with the central message of Christianity standing strong. Paul gives us an early creed of the Christian church in 1 Corinthians 15, 3-4. And he says, "For I delivered to you first of all that which I also received." He received it from Christ, he had it confirmed with the other apostles, and this was what the early church said in a creed format. He said that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, and that he was buried, and that he rose again the third day according to the Scriptures. You see, if Christ is not raised, our faith is empty, we're still in our sins, but the fact of the matter is that the dead do rise, and Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures. And if we place our faith alone in Christ, we can be redeemed because he is indeed risen. This was presented at Liberty Church of Cosby, March 7, 2007, by John Rush. I'm going to tack on to the end of this podcast what audio we do have from last night's presentation, and I hope that this has been helpful.
This is a data disc. It's not a compact disc to listen to in your car. It's a computer disc. It has several PDF files on it, which are document files that any computer should open. Okay, so they're a standard cross-platform document, unless your computer's a dinosaur. You know, if your computer's older than 3 months, it's a dinosaur. No, but... So there's some PDF files on there, and those are document files. Then we have, I put on some MP3 files, which are audio files, okay? And your computer should be able to play those. You can drop those into any iPods you may have if you're styling with the tech these days, okay? You can play those on any computer, play it with your MP3 player. These are... some audio files from one guy. I listened to one guy's, he did a PowerPoint presentation. I listened to his, listened to a couple of radio interviews, and I put those on this disc. And so you can copy these things. They're there to be copied and spread around because they're free podcasts. These are articles from blogs that are out there for people to have and to read. So take advantage of that. Okay. Tonight is First Wednesday, of course, it's the first Wednesday of the month. We have small group ministries here at Liberty Church. I want to encourage you to think about small groups. Get connected with that if you can. If you have any questions, we have directions to our small groups on the back table. We sure would like for you to consider being a part of that. But on first Wednesday, we always meet back here and have Bible seminar. And it just so happens that tonight's seminar is going to be about what happened last Sunday night on the Discovery Channel. And so we'll talk about that. And before we do, let's have a word of prayer. And Dick Nichols, would you pray for us? Let me again mention to you, my name is John Rush. We have some guests with us tonight. I have the privilege of pastoring here at Liberty Church. One of the elders here of, among three elders that are leading the church right now. And we are interested in helping people grow in their faith in a secular world. And it is exciting to know that there are solid, good reasons to believe in the Bible, to believe in Christ. The Bible is an anvil that has worn out many hammers over the centuries, and nothing has changed. And tonight we're going to talk about the Discovery Channel special that aired on March 4th on Sunday night. And we're going to talk about the facts behind the hype of the so-called lost tomb of Jesus. And so we're going to start by asking ourselves, what is going on? Well, like we said, March 4th, Discovery Channel aired a special and was produced by James Cameron, who was the man that has brought the Terminator series of movies to the big screen. He is the man that directed the movie The Titanic, and they have put this on. And it was a very well-produced documentary in the sense of visuals. The content had a lot to be desired, but if you saw it, then you saw that it was very well put together in the terms of the production values. Just for my own curiosity, how many of you saw that production on Sunday night? Okay, a few of you. Okay, well, many of you are going to be talking about it. How many of you have already talked to somebody about it? Okay, more than that have seen it. Okay, well, this is going to be an open window for us for a while to open up conversation to talk about the lost tomb of Jesus. Well, what is this documentary about? It is about a tomb that was discovered in Jerusalem known as the Talpiot Tomb. And they were excavating to start building some apartments and to put up these buildings, and they found this tomb in 1980. So this story is 27 years old. The tomb belonged to an upper middle class Jewish family. There are about 900 similar tombs like this have been unearthed in the same area. And inside this tomb, there were 10 ossuaries. We'll talk about those. Six of these ossuaries had the inscriptions of names on them. And this information comes from Wikipedia. The question you might be asking yourself is, what is an ossuary? An ossuary is a bone box. During about a 100-year period in Israel's history, which happens to be the first century, pretty much, the Jews would lay out those that had passed away, put them in a tomb, and for a year these bodies would decompose. Then a year later, they would come back, get those bones, and put them in a box. I have heard people say that the use of ossuaries is really an anticipation of resurrection. They were saving the bones for resurrection. I don't know if that's totally accurate. Others have said that the ossuaries were used simply because they helped reduce the space that was taken up in a tomb. But what are the facts about the Talpiot tomb? Well, there were 10 ossuaries found in the tomb. Six of them had names written on them. One had in Aramaic, well, they were all in Aramaic except one. One said, Jesus, son of Joseph. Another said, Mary. Another said, Josie, which is a rare nickname, supposedly rare, for the name Joseph. Another ossuary had the name Matthew inscribed on it. And the fifth one said, Judah, son of Jesus. And then there was another ossuary with a Greek inscription on it that said Mariaminu. And it is the main argument for the documentary on the lost tomb of Jesus. And we'll talk about Mariaminu or Mariamna in just a moment. What is the claim of this documentary? The claim of the documentary is that the family tomb of Jesus Christ of the New Testament has been found. The claim is that Jesus and Mary Magdalene were married. The claim is also that Jesus and his wife had a son named Judah. And they are also claiming then that Jesus' body was placed in an ossuary that was a year-long process, and therefore the claim is that Jesus did not rise physically from the dead. So these are issues that fly right in the face of the faith of Christianity that is rooted in Scripture. However, this is a great opportunity for the church. And I'm excited about this. This is almost like setting up a softball on a tee and just let me have all the time I need to hit it with the bat. This is a really great opportunity. I'm not upset. I'm not angry. I was telling Ruth tonight, this is like big game night. When I was getting ready for a basketball game in high school, I was like, yeah, this is fun. I like this stuff. Keep throwing it at us. Gives us opportunity to learn and understand that our Christian faith is rooted in history. We're talking about a faith that is rooted in reality, not some existential, spiritualized stuff that is not connected with reason or history or the footprints of God in time. Also, it's a great opportunity because the world is thinking about the issue. The whole world is focused on Jesus Christ of Nazareth and whether he rose again from the grave. Isn't that great? Amen. The Christians, as Christians, we are challenged to study. Christians in this room, let me tell you something. The days of just hooping and hollering without any grounds of study and rooted intellectual understanding are over. It is time for the church to get the books out, get the Bible out, read, study, and do our best. Now, we're not all going to become archaeologists. We're not all going to become New Testament scholars. We're not going to learn Hebrew and Greek, but we can do the best we can because people are going to need answers from the church. And it's an opportunity that is handed to us on a silver platter. What are the issues at hand? Well, tonight I want to talk about the names that were found in the tomb. Also, we want to talk about the DNA evidence, because when you say DNA evidence, Americans go, "Oh, that's it." We bend our knee at the altar of DNA, thanks to television shows like CSI and other things. Also, the producers of this documentary relied heavily on, quote, statistical evidence that showed that this has to be the tomb of Jesus Christ of Nazareth of the New Testament. Now, the reason why I'm being clear about who I'm talking about is because this can all be very tricky. And Tim and I were talking about this afternoon. As we go through the details here, I need two things from you, and I know that you're going to give them to me. First of all, you're going to have to think with me. We've got to trudge through some things, but I think you'll find it very intriguing. But we're going to have to think. And secondly, we have to distinguish between the Jesus of the Talpiot tomb and the Jesus of the New Testament, because this documentary is trying to blend those two characters into one. But we have to make sure, if at any time you get confused about, am I talking about the Talpiot Jesus or am I talking about the New Testament Jesus, just pull your earlobe or something and I'll try to make it clear. Okay? But we've got to keep these two things in our mind very distinct. The family tomb. This was a family tomb that has several people that were in it. But we have to understand the names of the time. The names Joseph and Jesus were very popular in the first century. Jesus appears in at least 99 tombs and on 22 ossuaries. The name Joseph appears on 45 ossuaries. If you're just talking about tombs by themselves, Joseph is found on 218. The word Judah is found on 164. Jesus is found almost 100 times, and Matthew is found 62 times. And all of these slides are sourced. This is from Richard Bauckham, professor of New Testament at St. Andrews. If you have any questions about any of these sources, I'd like to get them to you. Each one of these pretty much has a source. Richard Bauckham also goes on to tell us that we should note that the surviving six names are only six of many more who were buried in this family tomb. There may have been as many as 35. The six people whose names we have could have belonged to as many as four different generations. In case I don't mention this a little bit later, we have Aramaic and we have one in Greek. That can show, for a variety of reasons, that this was a multi-generational tomb. This is a large family tomb, which would certainly have been used for quite some time by the same family. We should not imagine a small family group. Some members of the family of Jesus, we know, speaking of the Jesus of the New Testament, lived in Jerusalem for only 3 decades, from the death of Jesus to the execution of his brother James in A.D. 62. None of our other evidence would suggest that there were so many of them as to require a tomb of this size. So the family of Jesus Christ would not require a tomb the size of what was found in Talpiot. Well, let's talk about some of these names in particular, okay? Let's talk about Jesus, son of Joseph. This photograph comes from the Discovery Channel itself, and it says Yeshua Bar Yosef in Aramaic lettering scratched crudely into the narrow side of a chest under the rim. The first name is preceded by a long cross mark of unknown significance, and the translation is Jesus, son of Joseph. But the Israeli archaeologist who first cataloged the ossuaries says the name Jesus, son of Joseph, has been found on 3 or 4 ossuaries. So we found the name Joseph on several ossuaries. We found the name Jesus on several ossuaries. You take the two names and put them together in one phrase, Jesus, son of Joseph, that has been found 3 or 4 other times. Give me scientific evidence, Amos Cloner says, and I'll grapple with it. But this assertion of the documentary is manufactured. This is the man who first cataloged the tomb. Now, Stephen Pham, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, he's the president of Jerusalem's University of the Holy Land, and he's an expert in Semitic languages. Pham told National Geographic News that he also has some doubts about the movie's claims. Now listen to this. He said, I don't think it says Yehoshua. I don't think the ossuary says Jesus. It says Hanun or something. Fan said after viewing high-resolution images of the ossuary inscription in question. So there is a little bit of doubt of whether it even says Jesus, son of Joseph. Another man named Dr. Charles Quarles. He's the chair of Christian Studies at Louisiana University. Anybody from Louisiana in here? Even by the calculations of the authors of the Jesus Family Tomb, the book that parallels the documentary, there were approximately 1,008 men named Jesus, son of Joseph, who lived in first century Palestine. They calculate that one out of every 79 Jewish males in Palestine during the century of ossuary use was named Jesus, son of Joseph. Okay, and that comes from biblicalfoundations.org. So, a couple of things. There is some minor dispute about the inscription saying Jesus in the first place. But I don't see that really being a major argument. But even if it does say Jesus, son of Joseph, and it looks like it does, there's nothing unusual about it. Okay? What about this name, Mariamne? The Discovery Channel's website says Mariamne Amara in Greek lettering, incised on the top center of the long back side. And the English translation, now notice what the Discovery Channel puts up on top of their website, Mary, known as Master. Now they are going to say that the Mary in the Mariamne ossuary is Mary Magdalene. My question is, how does Mary Magdalene get into the picture? The producers of this film would like to lead you to believe that because of an ancient text known as the Acts of Philip, we know that Mariamne is Mary Magdalene, and we know that Mary Magdalene was the wife of Jesus. They in the documentary, they relied heavily on the Acts of Philip. They say that Mariamne means Mary Magdalene, the master, the true leader of the early church. That's their assertion. My question is the Mariamne ossuary containing Mary Magdalene? What is going on? Now, we're going to talk about this for a minute because this is the key argument, among others, of the whole documentary. It is the key assertion of the movie. Now, let me talk a little bit about the Acts of Philip. The Acts of Philip is a 14th century document that some people have placed to have been written as early as the 4th century. Okay, about 300 years after Christ. Now, the Acts of Philip do not identify Mariamne or Mariamne or Mariamne. It's kind of hard to get which lettering is absolutely correct. But the Acts of Philip do not identify Mariamne as Mary Magdalene. Rather, it identifies her as the sister of Philip the Apostle. This is according to Ben Witherington, another expert on these issues. So, the Acts of Philip. I don't know how else to say it, but their assertion that the Acts of Philip identify Mary Magdalene, their assertion that the Acts of Philip identify Mariamne as Mary Magdalene, and that Mary Magdalene, as Mariamne, was married to Jesus, is just not in the Acts of Philip. This is spun up out of whole cloth. The Acts of Philip, not Mary Magdalene. The Mariamne of the text is nowhere stated to be married to Jesus. This assertion is completely empty. Read the Acts of Philip for yourself. Go online, type in the Acts of Philip. You can read it. I read it yesterday. It is tedious reading. They have Philip being pressured by, I believe it was, if I remember correctly, Ananias of Jerusalem, pressuring Philip, and so Philip makes the ground open up and swallow him up to his ankles, and they argue back and forth, and then Philip has the ground open up again and swallow Ananias up to his hips, and they argue back and forth, swallow Ananias up to his neck, and they argue back and forth, and then Philip just does away with him. Okay, it's a Superman Philip type thing. Also, a goat and a leopard were converted to Christ in the Acts of Philip. It's very fanciful. You can read this for yourself if you can spend the time and you have enough ibuprofen for your head. Now, in our culture today, Mary Magdalene is a very intriguing figure, a very intriguing person in history. And much of this is a hangover and a holdover from what? The Da Vinci Code, written by Dan Brown. And there are other people who have written about Mary Magdalene throughout history. Here are some things that have been said about Mary Magdalene. First of all, was Mary Magdalene a prostitute? Well, that has been asserted. But according to Daryl Bach in his book Breaking the Da Vinci Code, the first mention of Mary as a prostitute comes from a sermon or a homily delivered by Pope Gregory the Great in AD 591. In all likelihood, this notion resulted from confusion concerning passages in the Gospels of Luke and of John. The New Testament nowhere tells us that Mary Magdalene lived this kind of lifestyle. It's just not there. It's asserted. Was Mary Magdalene present at the cross as Jesus' wife? If you watch the documentary, you saw a reenactment of Mary Magdalene as Christ's wife weeping at the foot of the cross with their son Judah. We'll talk about him later. It's important also to know that, as Daryl Bach mentions, in each note about her presence at the cross, Mary Magdalene was not alone, but was part of a larger group of women. For example, Mary, Jesus' mother, the mother of James and Joseph, and the mother of the sons of Zebedee. It wasn't just Mary Magdalene in a very special presence of her own at the foot of the cross as the wife of the crucified. And that leads finally to this question, was she even ever considered to be Jesus' wife? Daryl Bach goes on to say, there is no clear text outside the Bible indicating that Jesus was married, period, or that Mary Magdalene was his wife. There's two notes there. The Bible never says that he was married, and let alone married to Mary Magdalene. This is also what matches the New Testament. So that this quote is saying, outside the New Testament, you don't find it. Inside the New Testament, you don't find it. Anywhere around the first century literature, you don't find it. In other words, it's not there. My question is, what does it matter? And here's a quote from John Rush. The Jesus-Mary Magdalene connection appeals to our tabloid mentality. It is the ancient equivalent of grocery store checkout aisle publications. Dan Brown has promoted this connection to highlight feminist viewpoints and historical fabrications in the thoroughly debunked Da Vinci Code. The issue at hand is historical accuracy. Would it have been wrong? Would it have demoted Christ in any way for him to have been married? No. I don't believe that that would rock our theology. The fact of the matter is, though, he wasn't. So we have to be accurate here, because the truth matters. The Discovery website says about the Mariamne ossuary. We're talking about Mary Magdalene. This is the only inscription in Greek in the tomb, and that is correct, at least on the ossuaries. In the documentary, they said there was an inscription on the wall of the tomb. So I don't know how you want to take that statement. So they're sloppy on some things. They said this is the only inscription in Greek in the tomb. They should have said on the ossuaries. Though Mara is a diminutive of Mary, it is also the Aramaic word for master. It conceivably might have been a term of respect for Mary Magdalene. Now, I want you to focus in with me right here. We said that the inscription said Mariamne e Mara, meaning Mary Magdalene. They read into that from a 14th century document thought to be written in the 4th century. They're reading back into Mariamne, Mary Magdalene. So they've read into that. We've exposed that as an empty assertion. Now, the language says, the inscription in Greek, though Mara, what's this Mara business? They say, though Mara is a diminutive of Mary, it is also the Aramaic word for master. Now, what does diminutive mean? If you say James, and you call, let's say your boy's name James, okay? And we don't call you this, but if we called you Jimmy, that would be a diminutive of the name James. Does that make sense? Joseph, Joey. That's the diminutive. What they're saying, and it's, they acknowledge it on the Discovery Channel website, that Mara is a diminutive of the name Mary. Actually, it's a diminutive of the name Martha. Okay? But notice what they say now. They're saying it's written in Greek. It means Mary or Martha. Now, notice what they say. It is also the Aramaic word for master. So now what they want you to do is you're riding your Greek horse, and in the middle of the stream, they want you to hop off the Greek saddle and jump on the Aramaic saddle for no good reason. They lay the Aramaic word right up next to the Greek word, associate a little bit, and they want you to jump over like a spark. Now, the Aramaic word means master. It sounds alike. It is conceivable. It conceivably might have been a term of respect for Mary Magdalene. Now, they lay this foundation that Mariamne means Mary Magdalene. It's totally empty. Now they say Mara in Greek, Mara in Aramaic, hocus pocus, put some fog in the air. It could have been. Do you see what they're doing? This is not scholarship. This is sensationalism. It's why this thing's going to collapse. No serious scholar that I could find is taking this seriously. Now, folks, let me put some disclaimer here. I'm not a scholar. I'm not an archaeologist, nor the son of an archaeologist. I am not an academic. I'm just a guy trying to do his best here. However, you can see what you can see, and these things are all out in the open for everybody to see. And if you got common sense, you can say that A is not non-A at the same time and in the same relationship. You can distinguish what needs to be distinguished. So they say it could have been this. Now, they make that statement, and then they jolly well go on their way asserting that Mary Magdalene is the master of the early church. And now they jump back into a Da Vinci Code-style conspiracy theory saying that Peter or the early church wanted to put Mary Magdalene down because they were patriarchal bigots. What they're doing is they're reading back their late 20th century, early millennial political persuasion all the way back 2,000 years into the first century. And the problem is that Americans who do not know the Bible, do not know their history, do not care, they're more eager to watch The Shopping Network or American Idol, they're more interested in these things, they think that because these things have been repeated enough, then it's true. One website said this is probably the first documentary that was thoroughly debunked before it aired. It's dead in the water, but Americans don't know that. Let's talk more about Mariamne. This is also from the Discovery Channel's own evidence page. They have a PDF file that you can download. It's their own evidence page about the find at Talpiot. They say Mara is a contraction of Martha. Do you see what they're saying? And it is used here as a second name. So, Mariamne a Mara. In other words, it could have said Mary